Please call and support this radio station. The number is 212-209-2950. 212-209-2950. Become a WBAI buddy, make a one-time donation, or support any program that you support from Democracy Now! On to the whole schedule. That number again, 212-209-2950. Call and make a pledge. And please do stay tuned for our programming at 11 a.m., Heart of Mind, Radio for the New Millennium. At noon, The Gary Knowles Show. And coming up now is Dream Leapers with Harriet Cole.
World leaders gathered in... Hello, everyone, and welcome to Dream Leapers with Harriet Cole. I'm so happy to be with you today. It is Black Music Month. You know, we celebrate Black music all year long, at least many of us do. But in this month, it's a concentrated moment of celebration, of looking at the history of Black music, at looking at artists, executives, songs, just the creation of this rich legacy of Black music that has been important not just to African Americans, but really globally. And as I was thinking of who to talk to this week to celebrate Black music, I thought of someone I have known for so many years, I can't even remember when we first met. I feel like it's in my early days when I moved to New York to work for Essence. I certainly visited a nightclub that he owned, which I didn't even realize was his, way back in the day. You may have heard of it, Leviticus. It was a huge nightclub back in the 70s and early 80s. But I didn't know this about him when I met him. He was an executive with Schifflin and Somerset, which is Hennessy and Moet. You know those brands, I'm sure. He and his team were helping to curate some of the best parties for Black folk in New York City as I was building my career. And I met him when he was doing that. And we've had occasion to work on some things together. I did not know that in his early years, from college into, I guess, his early 30s, he was helping to build what we know as the disco scene for Black people. And he's the founder of what's called the Best of Friends, Inc. They had five different nightclubs, Leviticus being the one that I knew the best. I just thought it would be great to talk to him. So let's welcome right now, Noel Hankin.
Thanks so much, Harriet. It's a pleasure to be here and to chat with you.
Oh, it's so good to be with you, too. And you have, why we're talking about this is because you have written a book. It's called After Dark, Birth of the Disco Dance Party. And I have so enjoyed reading it. First of all, you have the most incredible memory, Noel. You, I'm like, whoa, you remember everything. But you and your partners were really integral in bringing disco to New York, to the Black community at a time when, well, way before Studio 54.
Oh, yeah. 6 years before they even opened their doors. 6 years.
Wow.
So it was a remarkable occasion. I'll tell you, when we first started, there was nothing happening for Black folks in Midtown. And
right.
We were beginning, when we graduated from college, a small number of us were in the corporate world working in Midtown Manhattan. And those numbers were growing, gradually, but growing. No company had a lot of us, but when you aggregate a few here, a few there, that's a lot of bodies. And
right.
No place to really go after work, after dark, people who go uptown or to black neighborhoods in the outer boroughs of Brooklyn and Queens. And so we recognize that, first of all, a lot of white folks were leaving the city also after dark because it was a high crime.
Leaving the city?
Yes, because they moved to the suburbs. The crime rate was extremely high. Murder rate, robberies. It was a dangerous city.
And what is the time period that we're talking about?
We're talking about the early 70s, 1971. And really, we got the idea for it in 1970. And pull the trigger in February 1971. So this is the 50th anniversary of our first discotheque in Midtown Manhattan.
Congratulations. And so for context, Noel, because we think of 1970 in the black community for a lot of things. That's when Essence was started, Black Enterprise was started.
Yes.
You know, Ebony had been there for many years prior, but the early 70s marked a change in the economy and the working world. As you point out, there were, even though it was early, there were corporate executives who were black. The people were beginning to climb the ladder at that point. So there were a lot of brothers and sisters in suits, let's say, right?
Yes.
And they needed somewhere to go.
Exactly.
And
right.
So here you are.
And we generally had a very optimistic attitude, aspirational for sure, and optimistic because we hadn't really heard much about the glass ceiling at that point.
Right.
So we were shooting high. And we created spaces and places for black folks and others because initially our clubs were very diverse. Mm-hmm. You know, as promoters, we went to clubs that were really catering to white folks typically before we walked in. And what we started off doing is we took a night here, two nights there, all in prestigious areas in Midtown Manhattan. And so the crowds we got initially were very diverse. A lot of white corporate folks were there, Latinos were there, gays and straights, celebrities, mailroom guys. We had everybody. And
That's very different, too, in terms of what the nightclub scene was like before that, right?
Yes, and very much so. The nightclub scene before that was more like Hippopotamus, Peppermint Lounge, more upscale, expensive, older, and more white.
Okay.
What we brought in was an environment where people came to dance. They didn't come to see or be seen. They came to dance. And my DJ partners used the technology that was available at that time to mix records in such a way that they could take a popular song like Theme from Shaft and extend it for like 10 minutes by repeating the bridge over and over and over again. It drove people wild. It was an experience that none of us had had prior to that. It was the first time.
And so, Noel, I'm glad you're giving context to this, because when you say it, like, we know this. We know all the equipment and technology that DJs have today. It's you don't have to scratch. You don't have to do whatever. You know, there are buttons you can push almost to make this happen. But 50 years ago, you didn't have that. You had turntables, right?
That's right. And not only that, there was no disco music. No disco music didn't exist. So here's where a lot of folks, in fact, I just wrote something about it today. A lot of folks don't realize this. James Brown did not create disco music, but James Brown helped to get it created. And here's why. In the early days, 1971, when we first started, February, what music got people up at the dance floor better than anybody else? James Brown. Let me tell you, he got them up. Get on up, Black and I'm Proud. We really use a lot of his music and Motown, a lot of others. You know, what our DJ partners, CP and Danny Berry, what they did was to curate hot tempo, infectious beats. They would scour records. Back then, you could go into a record shop, put on earphones, and listen to records before you buy them. So Danny would spend hours in the record shops listening to different tracks. And back then, you had to deal with 45s, which were like 3 minutes or less. So you had to be extraordinarily nimble and know how each song began and ended in order to make sure the dancers never missed a step going from one record to the next. It was seamless. And Danny and CP were superb at it. And gradually, they developed techniques to modify an existing good record in such a way that it just drove people crazy. And also, we had the best sound system we could afford, which meant when you heard music at our clubs, it was different than what you heard at home.
Mm. Which makes
notes.
Yeah.
You heard notes you've never heard before.
and for context, Noel, because, you know, people wonder, well, how did you make this happen? You talk in your book, After Dark, Birth of the Disco Dance Party, you talk about how you guys were in college hosting parties.
Yes.
And first going to parties and kind of checking them out and then hosting your own. Can you talk about the origins? Like, what got you to the point where you opened a nightclub in New York?
Sure. Well, we started off, I pledged Kappa Alpha Psi fraternity. And I learned how to give dances. Ricky and I were the top ticket sellers every time we gave a dance. We gave a couple of three dances a year. The Q's also gave a lot of dances. I went to all of those, the AKAs, the Deltas, everybody who gave dances, I went. And I learned how to give dances. And when I graduated from college, a group of us formed a social club, and we also started giving dances with live bands. And we were giving 3-4 dances a year just for fun, not to make money. It was just a social outlet kind of thing. It was fun to do. And we were good at it. So, you know, we did it. One day I got invited to a birthday party. I was working at Young & Rubicam, the big ad agency. They were number one in the country back then. And I got invited to a birthday party after work on a Wednesday. Mm-hmm. And it was at a place called La Martinique. I'd never heard of it before. And I'd never been invited to a birthday party in Midtown like that at a club. It wasn't someone's house. So when I went, I brought my friend Andre. He was part of our social group, too. And they were playing recorded music, and people were dancing like it was Saturday night in, you know, uptown. It was like, it was crazy. And I thought, this is what we should be doing instead of dances. This was so hot. It was so, I called an emergency meeting. There were 8 of us on the roster at that time. And I said, we need to do this. This is a better way to access this emerging black population in Midtown Manhattan. We can access them. They're ready to go. They're dressed nicely. They got money in their pockets. They have jobs. And they can walk to what we put together. Mm. So Tony and Danny, who were teachers, had off for the Christmas holiday. And they said, we'll go down there and check out La Martinique. They came back and they said, you know, La Martinique is just as you described. It's beautiful. It's elegant, but it's big. And I don't know if we can fill it. Mm. But we found a place around the corner about half the size called the Ginza. And the Ginza is also in a prestigious area, 58 between Park and Madison.
Very nice.
And why don't we start there and see, you know, it'd be easier to fill it, more of a chance of it being a success. Well, this is February 1971 when we started at the Ginza, 50 years ago. The first Thursday night, we had about 100 people. It's okay. The place held 300. The second Thursday.
So that felt a little bit empty.
Yeah, a little shy. You know, people weren't used to it. The second Thursday, we had 150 people. The third Thursday, we had 300.
All right.
And after that, as it started to warm up in March and April, the line was not only down the block, but around the corner.
Wow.
I mean, we couldn't let them all in because we wanted to make sure we kept the crowd size the same. So as people left, we let people in. And so we had a clicker so we could make sure we monitored it properly. But with that success at the Ginza, a couple months later, we went right back to La Martinique. And we wound up doing La Martinique with a huge success right off the bat. There was no gradual build by then. They knew what the deal was.
And how many could they hold?
Their C of O was around 800.
Wow. Okay, that's big.
So with a C of O of 800, that's a certificate of occupancy, you can put 1,200 people in there on a flow. So maybe it's 800 at a time, but some people come early and leave. Other people come late. And so on a flow, you get, you know, 1,100, 1,200 on a typical night.
That's something.
And we started raising the price. We went from $3 to $5 to $7 to $10. And so the money was rolling in, and we had to quickly scramble to transform ourselves from a social club into a business. And we had to adjust ourselves from a social club kind of mentality to business relationships. We set up the proper banking accounts, hired a high-powered lawyer who knew the Midtown area very well because he represented a lot of the license holders there, meaning people with a liquor license. mm-hmm. and also an accountant who had the same kind of background. And that proved to be a very wise move because it helped us down the road in many, many ways.
And did any one of the eight partners work full-time on the nightclubs, or was it always you having a job and doing that?
We all worked full-time. And what happened was gradually over a period of 2 years, these nightclubs where we promoted, we had a total of 7 events a week, 5 different clubs that we didn't know we promoted. And gradually what happened was their leases expired, so they decided not to renew, or they sold it, or they decided to retire. In one case, we were told that they don't want us to come back. They can stand at the door and collect the money, because that was the arrangement we had. We collect the entrance fee, they got the bar. And we were walking out with a lot of cash from every one of those clubs. So gradually they wanted to collect the cash, and we realized that was going to happen. So we saved our money. We had a lot of money to build our own clubs, and we started building. We wound up building 5 clubs, 3 in Manhattan. We were among the first Black-owned clubs in Midtown, and 1 in Brooklyn and 1 in Queens.
And tell us the names of the clubs.
Sure. In Queens was our first club, Lucifer's. And then we built Leviticus, which is our flagship in Midtown Manhattan. Mm-hmm. And nearby we built Othello's, which we renamed Justine's. And then we went to Brooklyn and we built Orpheus, which we renamed Brandy's. And then we bought a club. We built all those from scratch. Then we bought a club that was existing. We assumed their debt, no exchange of cash, called Bogard's on the east side. Bogard's had it was a small, more intimate kind of a feeling, and it was more like an after-work hangout where you could dance and have fun, and Stevie Wonder celebrated his birthday there, playing a whole, for free, playing a whole hour and a half.
Because he wanted to be there.
He wanted to be there. You know, he liked the fact that it was Black-owned.
Of course.
And he liked the vibe, you know, because we were all Stevie Wonder lovers. I mean, you know, we appreciated him and his music.
There's some really cool pictures in the book, After Dark, Birth of the Disco Dance Party, and there's a really cool young picture of Stevie Wonder. It's really, really nice. Let me remind folks, you're listening to Dream Leapers with Harriet Cole here on WBAI in New York City. That's 99.5 FM and everywhere online at WBAI.org. And we are talking to Noel Henkin. He's written this book. There's so much detail. You feel like you're in the clubs, in their heads, learning how he and his partners built the disco scene, which he just described. They had 5 clubs at the height of their work together. The book is called After Dark, Birth of the Disco Dance Party. And I'm telling you, to me, Noel, one of the things was this man has a photographic memory. I was talking to my husband about it, like, George, Noel remembers everything. That all these incredible details. One of them, early on in the book, you talk about the way the DJs mix the music and just even the strategy, you know, and everybody who's been to a nightclub, you know, you dance, and then you need to take a breath. And the DJ needs to know when do you take a breath, and the bar needs to be ready to serve whatever the drinks are, so that, I mean, you like the whole flow you describe really well. There's another thing you describe, which is, I mean, there's so many things that are interesting, but you know, who came to your nightclubs? You've already described Black professionals who were, as the Black professional class was kind of growing in New York City, this became a place where they could go in their various neighborhoods, but also in Midtown Manhattan. Look, even today, I don't know whether do we own clubs in Midtown Manhattan today?
I know we own some restaurants. I'm not sure about
Okay, restaurants, yes. I mean, I know that Jay-Z has had a club. I don't know whether it's still there, but it's still more like a restaurant, right?
Yeah, 40 anyway, club, yeah.
Right. Anyhow, in Midtown Manhattan, you have it. So who was coming? Because there are a lot of celebrities, a lot of people who are part of the, let's say, underworld as well. Tell us, you talk about all of them. Tell us about who came to your club.
Let me just say that to write the book, I spent hours debriefing each of my partners.
Oh, good.
And so I tapped into their memories. So they're not all my memories. Many of them are my partner's memories.
Well, that's good to know, because I'm like, a photographic memory is one thing, but this book is like, woo!
Well, I did the homework. I did the homework, as they say. I did a lot of research, and also to make sure that I put things in the right perspective, I did the research to make sure that what was happening in New York was reflected appropriately. And because that had a lot to do with our success. We could not have accessed those venues as promoters if New York City was thriving, but New York City was dying. It was so bad. A lot of people thought it would never recover.
And why was it dying, Noel?
It was dying because of the high crime rate, white flight, the tax levy was not enough to pay for all the things that the city needed to do. The services were weak. The long sanitation strike that left a tremendous health hazard in New York City. Mm-hmm. You had a post office strike that crippled Wall Street, almost shut down Wall Street. Wow. You had a recession that hit the country, but it hit New York City particularly hard. Yeah. A lot of folks really thought New York City would never recover. And so as people fled the city, we stepped in. Because most of us couldn't flee. We were stuck there. So right. We made the best of what the situation held for us. Now, in terms of who came, I'll tell you, we had everyone from Madonna to Alpha Ashe, from Elizabeth Taylor to Rick James. We had the New York Knicks hung out at mostly at Justine's, but they came to Leviticus quite a bit as well. Justine's was like three blocks away from the Garden. That's so after they played a game, they would always shoot down.
That was easy.
And when there were big concerts at the Garden, like the Whispers, when they came out with their big hit, they were too big to play at our club. But afterward, they would do their after parties at Leviticus.
Nice.
So, you know, we had a lot of after parties there and things like that.
And then at a certain point, a lot of political figures. Shirley Chisholm.
Yes, yes.
Tell us about her.
Mal Wolfuck was one of my partners. And what he did was introduce politicians to our venues, our clubs, as a way to introduce these politicians to Midtown Manhattan. Their fundraisers in our clubs were the first that took place in Midtown Manhattan. Wow. And Shirley Chisholm, when she was running for Congress in 1976, I think it was, she had a fundraiser at Leviticus. And she was such an amazing person. For those who've met her or read about her, you have to be inspired. She was a remarkable lady and the first woman to run for president, black or white.
1972, that's right. Yeah. A lot of people don't know that.
Yeah.
So when I read that she also came to your club to raise money later for the congressional seat, that's so important. I saw Percy Sutton. You had the whole gang of four, right?
Yes,
tell us
all
about
of them
them.
There. Yeah, Charlie Rangel. He has a comment he made. He said, "You guys get more people on a Saturday night than I get to vote for me every 2 years." He said, "If you ever decide to run for office, be sure to let me know." That's the way Charlie speaks.
Oh, yeah. But the fact that you had such a diverse group of people coming through there is significant. You know, that's not always true about establishments. You're often attracting a particular clientele, but this was quite a diverse clientele.
It was very different than the dances we gave were just our crowd. But because these were venues that were open to the public and in areas where whites lived and worked, we had extraordinarily diverse guests. Mm-hmm. And it was perhaps, when you think about it, it may have been the first time for a purely social environment we had that level of diversity.
Yeah.
Black, white, gay, straight, from the CEO to the mailroom workers, celebrities, sports figures. We had a target audience that we started off focusing on, which was the business, white-collar business men and women, black business men and women in Midtown, giving them a place to go because they didn't have a place to go before us.
Right.
And what happened was everyone wanted to be a part of it. If they were a blue-collar worker, a bus driver, they go home, put on their best suit. You couldn't tell from the senior executive next to them. So, you know, everyone wanted to be there, and they dressed up for it. They enjoyed dressing up, by the way.
Yeah.
And no one had to take dance lessons. they learn by watching other people and watching Soul Train or whatever. They figured it out.
Well, and you have a story in there about Don Cornelius being at the club, and actually contextually, I want to say this. I was telling my husband, I've been talking to my husband about this book as I'm reading it. I'm saying, George, did you know this? Did you know that? And I was asking him what, because he grew up first, like you, first in Jamaica and then in New York way before I got here. So he went to some clubs. But he told me that in the early days, it was kind of dangerous to go to some of the black clubs, that there was always somebody pulling out a gun, taking your money. So he was a little reluctant to do that. And you tell a story of having someone come into Leviticus and pull a gun. I think Don Cornelius was there then.
Yes,
tell us that story, because it'll give us a sense of the kind of protection that you had.
Well, we had very strict policies for dress and behavior inside the club. No drugs. If you were caught with drugs, you were banned for at least a month, depending on the infraction. And so we set out to manage the club in such a way that it would be safe and you felt comfortable inside, so that men and women could feel that this is a place where they could make friends, they could meet people who they might want to go into business with, and maybe even meet a spouse, someone who would become their spouse. But one night we had six guys came in with a shotgun. Ooh. And announced it was a stick-up. Shot off the shotgun into the ceiling to get everyone's attention. We later found out it was blanks. There was no bullet in the shotgun. But who knew?
Right.
So it created panic, and people rushed toward the back of the club. Don Cornelius was there that night along with a lot of other people, including some folks who I guess you call them hustlers or gangsters. They were people who were into the drug business. Mm-hmm. They didn't ply their trade at our clubs. They came there to spend their money. And the way we set up the club, we welcomed everyone as long as they behaved. As long as they were good inside the club, they were fine with us. And so this was a place where drug dealers, CEOs, everybody felt comfortable because there was nothing going on that was inappropriate around them. Well, anyway, this particular group of six guys, it was the only time Leviticus was ever robbed. They took money from the cash registers, the waitresses. They robbed several individuals. They fled, took the stairs up to the roof and jumped across climbed down the other side of the building and exited on 34th Street through a parking lot. And so that's the route we think they escaped. But what's interesting is that a few weeks later, three of them were found dead.
Ooh.
And the other three who robbed us were never found. Now, I told you who was in the room.
Yes,
they don't
did.
Like being robbed. And they they took note of who was there, because they didn't wear masks. They took note of who was there, and they figured out who it was. Leviticus was never robbed again. The interesting thing is our clubs were so safe, we never had fights.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we might have had somebody who was upset with something, but never had a fight. And for those tens of thousands of people, hundreds of thousands going through the clubs every year, it's amazing. During a very high crime time. And so I think our policies and our strategies for those dress and behavior policies work very well.
Well, and those are the kinds of policies. I pledged Delta in college. I know that whole scene. Mm-hmm. It's organized. It's, there are lots of rules. You have to follow the rules if you want to be part of that world. And I'm sure that helped, along with when you have friends in all different kind of spaces, then you have a different kind of protection between the rules and the folks who were part of all different aspects of New York City life, the bad guys, so to speak, who weren't being bad when they were in your space, right?
Yeah, one thing we learned, and we learned this fairly early on, when you have people dress up, they behave differently.
Yes.
They behave better. And, when you have some notorious people, Nicky Barnes came through the club, New York Freddie Myers, Black Ronnie, we had a lot of different characters.
These are people who I bet a lot of folks listening know those names.
Yep. They may. But the thing is, they were such a small presence, you hardly even noticed them. They weren't, it wasn't like the club was filled with these kinds of guys. It was sure. Like, you know, they were there on occasion, one or two here, there. But the, you know, when you have 800 people in the room and they're all there to have fun, and no matter what you do for a living, even if it's illegal, you still have a need for socializing. And these are young people, you know. Frank Matthews, he never came to Leviticus, by the way, but Frank Matthews is like roughly our age, maybe a year older. And he was the biggest drug dealer in the history of the United States up to that point, representing 20, according to the New York Times, 25% of all the heroin brought into this country. Ooh. He's the one that put it in the coffin of the dead soldiers, put heroin in the coffins.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, there's a movie. They don't equate it to Frank Matthews. They kind of make it seem like it's somebody else, but it was Frank Matthews who did that.
Wow. So many stories. Hey, guys, you're listening to Dream Leapers with Harriet Cole here on WBAI in New York City. That's 99.5 FM and everywhere online at WBAI.org. We're traveling down memory lane with Noelle Henkin, who has written a wonderful book with so much juicy detail starting from 50 years ago.
Yes.
The book is called After Dark, Birth of the Disco Dance Party. And it really is looking at the disco dance party as it relates to primarily African-American culture, not only, but this is where it was started, as Noelle said, to really service Black folks in Midtown, professional folks who wanted a place to go, swell to include Madonna. And I saw a picture where Andy Warhol was there one day
as well.
And right now, this book exists as an ebook, and Noelle has graciously offered books to us here at WBAI as a gift to you. We welcome you to make a contribution to WBAI. As you know, we're listener sponsored. We don't have any ads whatsoever, just you who are listening, who appreciate the folks we come on to tell us incredible stories like Noelle's. And then you can read even more. For a donation of $20, you can get a copy of Noelle's ebook, After Dark, Birth of the Disco Dance Party. We want to get the word out. We want to get the word out about his book. As we move into summer, it's a really fun read. It'll probably get you up dancing as you're thinking about it. And he's giving us books in exchange for your $20 donation to WBAI. So you can call us at 212-209-2950. I'll repeat that because it's a new number, 212-209-2950. You could also go to give to the numeral two, WBAI.org. And as many of you know, but in case somebody doesn't, you can become what we call a BAI buddy. That's when you give a contribution every month to help us keep the lights on, help us keep everything going, you know, to help oil the machine. That's called a BAI buddy, and you can become a BAI buddy in the name of Dream Leapers. That would be amazing. You can make a one-time contribution, and you can make a contribution of $20 to receive a copy of Noelle's book, After Dark, Birth of the Disco Dance Party. And what I love, which I've said already, but I just want to repeat it, is the detail. So you can read this book, and even if you weren't there, you'll feel like you were there, and you can talk about it like you were there, because Noelle did the homework. And Noelle, you know, as one who has written a number of books, I will say what I appreciated was that you did give the context, you give the details so that people can be transported to the environment, to the experience, and all of that is so important in terms of the reader feeling like he or she is there, you know, and that's not the easiest thing to do. So you did a great job, and you told me, cause I didn't know you were working on a book. We often see each other at one of our favorite places in the world, which is in Sag Harbor, on Long Island, where a community of folk come together, especially in the summers. I saw you. You didn't tell me you were working on this book. So give us some insight, because you have a story that I ask people all the time. What did you do during COVID, during quarantine? Tell us about this book and how you used your time well.
Yeah, thank you. Well, you know, one of the things I read during the this COVID situation is that reading is up 35%. Because I guess folks are home more and have more time. They're not commuting. And I started to rewrite the book before the pandemic started. But when it did start, I thought, this is a golden opportunity to finish the book. And I had only put a little bit of work into it at that point.
Right.
So I got on the phone with my partners, took a lot of notes, reams of notebooks with notes, capturing events and situations that some of them I didn't even know about because my partners experienced it, not me. Mm-hmm. So I reflected a lot of this and put it together so that when you read this book, it really gives you the context. Here was the main impetus for me writing the book, because we talked about it from 30, 40 years ago. We need to write a book about what we did, because when my cohort dies out, no one will remember it if there's nothing in writing.
That's
and,
right.
A lot of people, when you say disco, the first thing that pops into their mind was Studio 54 or John Travolta
in
Saturday Night Fever. And the thing is, that was 6 years after we started. That didn't happen right out of the clear blue. It happened because of the momentum and the stage we set. We paved the road for that to happen.
That's right.
And we popularized what became that disco era. And in fact, it became so powerful, over 100 stations across this country, radio stations, changed their format from rock to disco. And you know what that did? It pissed off white male rockers primarily.
They
were the ones who created this disco sucks thing. They didn't want to get dressed up. They didn't want to pay an admission. And they didn't want to have to take dance lessons because they couldn't dance the way they felt they wanted to. So they rebelled. And the word disco became really toxic. But the thing is, that's interesting, the music never became toxic.
That's true.
The music remained powerful and still is a powerful influence to this day. Mm-hmm. Now, one other thing I want to talk about is the origin of the music, because we know that the disco music didn't just pop up. It came from somewhere, and it came out of the black experience, and I want people to know that. It came out of R&B, funk, and soul music, and by my DJ partners curating the particular songs and cuts that had a hot tempo that's danceable, what happened was our patrons start calling the radio stations, like WBLS, saying, how come you're not playing so-and-so? You got to play Mata de Mongo. You got to play this. You got to play that. And so the radio station said, whoa, where are these guys getting these songs from? We never played it.
Right.
And they started sending their executives and their DJs to Leviticus and our other clubs to see what's making people get up on the dance floor, what's popular, because they can't tell on the radio. And so we got close to the radio station, folks. You know, that's why Frankie Crocker was there.
Yes.
And he hired Vaughn Harper when Vaughn Harper was emceeing one of our shows. And Frankie hired him, got him to become a DJ on WBLS, and the rest is history. Vaughn became one of the top DJs in the country.
No question. And in your book, there are few chapters that kind of talk about that. So you talk about Vaughn Harper and Frankie Crocker. There's a whole chapter talking about that relationship. And both of them became legendary.
Yes.
And people still know them. You also talk about folks who I met when I first moved to New York, the Dow twins, identical twins, one of whom is still with us, who were ubiquitous around New York City in terms of creating parties. Tell us a little bit about them.
The Dow twins were unusual in that they were perhaps the best known black men in New York City, in New York, the whole Northeast, really. They were extremely well known, Norman and Harold Dow. They were mirror twins. Norman was a lefty. Mirror twins is one's a righty, one's a lefty.
Oh, okay.
Norman was a lefty. Norman was the front man. He was the one out there. He was the one holding Elizabeth Taylor's hand in the photograph. Harold was the behind-the-scenes guy who solved the problems, and Norman was the front guy who dealt with the public, pretty much. And they were managers. We hired them as managers of Justine's, which was our second most important club. Right. And we were concerned about cannibalization because it was only five, six blocks away from Leviticus. It was so close, you know, we didn't want to cannibalize our precious crowd at Leviticus. So the Dow twins were 5 years younger than us, extremely loyal, honest men. We could trust them completely. They did a spectacular job because they were two of the top promoters in New York.
Yes.
They gave, let me tell you something, they gave for 25 years a big dance on the Intrepid Space.
I read that, Noel. I didn't even know about this. 25 years. First of all, I didn't even realize that there were parties on the Intrepid, but you tell a great story in the book of how the Intrepid, they were trying to move the Intrepid at one point. tell that story. That's a good one.
Well, the Dow twins had 2,500 people every year for their big dance. It was a lot of folks dancing. They had two decks. The top deck was R&B music. They had DJs playing that. And down below, they had DJ, but also live Latin music. So they had Latin bands down there. And when you're on the top deck, you're looking at the skyline of New York City on the top deck of a flat top. And the Dow twins were the only promoters, black or white, allowed to give parties on the Intrepid, by the way.
Why? Because I mentioned it to my husband. He said, I didn't know they were allowed to do that.
they were the only ones allowed to do it because they managed the crowd so well. It was such a well-behaved crowd, and they were so buttoned up. And they did everything exactly right. And they got sponsors to help them. It was a magical experience to be on that deck. But with all those people dancing, the year they tried to take the Intrepid, they tried to, six tugboats pulling the Intrepid to take it to a port for renovation. They couldn't move it. It moved like 2 feet. And Ken Spider-Webb was on the radio. He said, those Dow twins gave so many parties on the Intrepid, it dropped it deep into the mud. They couldn't move it.
I love that story. Whether it's true or not, I love it. That's a great story. So now you also talk about when Studio 54 is being developed and how Steve Rubell actually came to you guys to ask how you had developed your business to see what he could learn. So first of all, the fact that you gave advice is something that probably many people wouldn't have done. But you were really generous with your advice. And tell us about talking to him and what was created with Studio 54 and how it really was very different from what you had created.
Well, Steve Rubell, he did have some experience with a nightclub that he had, a small nightclub, forgot exactly the location. But he came by twice to ask us how we did what we did, how we charged, how we our dress codes and so forth. And he's a very smart guy. I give him credit. He's gay. And what he wanted to do is something different because he felt that he wanted to have something different than suits. We had people in suits and ties. A lot of them had suits and ties on. And that's why he created almost the complete opposite of everything we did is what he did. So our admission price back then when he first came was around $5. I think it went up to $7 shortly thereafter. He was charging $15 to $20. Our crowd could not afford that.
Right.
So right off the bat, he had a different crowd. We knew it would be different, so we had no reservation about sharing what we did with him because we knew it would be a totally different crowd. But he did personally, he wrangled a lot of celebrities. He appealed to the media big time. We avoided the media because we didn't want the radio stations to promote our clubs because while 99% of the people that would come based on a radio announcement are great people, that 1% is not so great. You don't want them in the room.
You wanted more word of mouth.
Yes, because, you know, again, high crime. What Steve's Studio 54 wound up doing is filtering out people because of the price. You know, $15, $20 to get in, that's a pretty high price. And the drinks were expensive as well. But he personally did celebrity wrangling. He hired a professional wrangler to bring in celebrities. And the media could not get enough of him. The problem, though, he created hurt the whole disco industry. Because he was quoted in an article saying that we at Studio 54 make more money than everybody except the mafia. So the IRS came down with six, I forgot how many agents, it wasn't six, it was like a dozen agents. They raided Studio 54. They found drugs. They found money, cash in the ceiling. It's all in the New York Times. And they arrested them. And they were eventually convicted and given a sentence of 3 years.
Right.
Now, they shortened it to 1 year by sharing what they thought were clubs that were hiding money. And in fact, about four clubs were shut down based on that. And they did release Steve and Ian Schrager, his partner, after 1 year. So they got out early. The IRS came to our club. Steve didn't put the finger on us, but they came because we're a discotheque.
Your popular discotheque, sure.
And the IRS had a guy with a clicker at our door on a Saturday night counting the bodies. And they multiplied that by seven and thought that's what our weekly take would be. Well, we had to explain to them, no, Saturday night is not like a Monday night.
That's
you get
right.
more people on a Saturday night. So after we went through that with them, we didn't have any problem with the IRS. They never touched us. But they did close down a lot of discotheques,
sure.
and it hurt the industry overall.
Well, and you describe how at Studio 54, you know, the more outlandish the outfit, the more extreme the personality.
Yes.
Along with, of course, celebrities and notables, that became the thing. It was multiracial, although predominantly white.
Yes, it was predominantly white. The only black folks that were there pretty much were celebrities.
Right, right. And a few friends of,
yeah,
right.
Yeah.
And there were a lot of drugs. I remember I talked to Norma Kamali, who was very good friends with Ian Schrager, mm-hmm. who said she loved him, but she didn't go to the club because she didn't do drugs. And she just didn't even want to be in the mm-hmm. company of that because the drugs were everywhere.
They were everywhere. And they dispensed them. Steve Rebell actually dispensed the drugs, according to sources I've read.
How were you able to keep drugs out?
You know, I give credit to Tony Cooper, who was our president. What he did was he established ground rules for how to relate to people. We respected everyone, and we made it clear that we expect them to respect us mm-hmm. back. And so with the drug dealers, they weren't there to ply their trade. Pimps weren't there to ply their trade. Whatever, numbers runners or bankers, they weren't there to ply their trade. They were there for only one thing. That was their occasion to relax and to enjoy themselves.
Right.
And as long as they did that, there was no way for us to throw them out or block them from coming in. So we welcomed them as long as they behaved. And they understood that. And they wanted to have a place where they could go. They viewed some of us, like Tony and some of the other guys, as friends.
Yes.
You know, when you're doing illegal things, you can't afford to get too close to anybody. And that was exactly how my partners felt. They weren't about to get too close to any of those guys.
Hey, and it worked. Hey, guys, you're listening to Dream Leapers with Harriet Cole here on WBAI in New York City. That's 99.5 FM and everywhere online at WBAI.org. It's always amazing to me how fast these interviews go, especially when you've got somebody on like Noel Henkin who has all of the stories, and all of these stories are in his new book. This is an incredible book. I have been reading. It's called After Dark, Birth of the Disco Dance Party. It's the 50th anniversary of the start of disco. So those of you out there who are of a certain age, you remember disco, you remember. and what he's explaining is that really it was like people like James Brown who really helped to start it. And then disco, like so many other musical traditions, has its roots in black culture. And this
Absolutely.
Is Black Music Month.
Yes.
And I just thought it would be so important to give some more historical context to the impact that African Americans have had on our culture. This part, I don't know how many people knew that African American culture in particular represents the roots of this craze that was so important for many, many years. And of course, the music still lives on.
If
you would like to have a copy of Noel's book, After Dark, Birth of the Disco Dance Party, he is gifting us copies because he understands we need your support. So this is us kind of sharing. He will give you a copy of his ebook if you make a $20 donation to WBAI. As you know, we're completely listener sponsored. That means you. Whoever's listening, we need you. But it's wonderful when our guests have a great gift that they can offer to you. And I can tell you from having written many books myself, the best possible thing is to put that book in somebody's hands and to have the person read it. And I promise you, you're going to enjoy After Dark, Birth of the Disco Dance Party, because it's really well written. Noel used his time well during during quarantine, this long quarantine. Yes. So write a book is not easy, right, Noel?
No, it's not easy at all.
Not at all. So let me just give folks the number, 212-209-2950. 212-209-2950. You can call and you can make a donation of $20 and receive a copy of the book. You can also go online to give to the numeral 2WBAI.org. We appreciate you. I appreciate bringing on guests who make us smile and take us back. And Noel Henkin has just such an incredible story, and I'm really pleased that he has written it down so that we can know. So one of the things you write about, Noel, which is funny and real, is John Travolta. So we know Saturday Night Fever was such a huge movie.
Yes.
And here's this white man who gets on stage and he can dance and he can, you know, he can do the disco dances that were becoming popular. You tell some interesting stories. One of the two people who taught him, the person who perfected the choreography, is friends with your wife. Is that correct?
My wife's mother.
Your good wife's friends, mother.
My wife's mother, yes. He since passed away, but yeah, he taught John Travolta how to move with as much rhythm as he could get it to move with. and it was a huge success. You know, that movie really was like a shot in the arm for our discotheque. When that movie hit, our attendance increased and the number of white patrons increased also.
Isn't that something?
So it was beneficial to us. That helped us. That was many years after we started.
Sure.
And, you know, we were featuring discotheques, the discotheque dancing, but we also had live music every Thursday night. We had some great bands and groups. As a matter of fact, one night, a young man came with his little sister and tried to get, CP was the guy who booked all the talent for us.
Mm-hmm.
And he wanted to play on one of our Thursday nights. And CP said, no, you're not really just not. You're not known. You don't have people don't know you. You're not going to be a draw, because we were getting groups like the Whispers before they made it real big. We had the Originals. We had Blue Magic, Cuba Gooding with the Main Ingredient. You know, groups like that. All well known. We had Taste of Honey with Boogie Oogie Boogie Boogie. It was groups that would attract the crowd. So he turned this young man down. A year later, he came out with an album that sold a million copies. His name was Prince.
I was thinking it was Prince. Oh, did you ever get him back?
No, he was too big. With that first album, actually, it was the second album. First album came in really low on the charts, like 190 or something. But the second album was titled Prince. It blew up so big, he was too big for us. I'll tell you what, we played a lot of his music, though.
I bet you did. You know, it's so funny. So I grew up in Baltimore, and when I was in high school so I graduated in 79. So I was in high school when disco was everything. And at this point, you know, in other cities, it was really big.
Oh,
and I was the disco queen in my high school.
No
I had
kidding.
A dance partner. There was this club called Odell's, which was a big, big dance club in Baltimore. And we used to go out, Noel, and people would clear the floor to watch us dance.
Whoa.
I was in dance contests. My mother, because I was so young, my mother took us. Because I was underage, she had to take us and sign for me to be in the contest. So when I mean, I'm so into what you are talking about.
I want to see those moves, Harriet.
I have to see if we have pictures. We did the acrobatics, all kinds of crazy stuff. But I remember, you know, even as being someone who was from a much smaller city than New York, that it traveled everywhere. Disco traveled everywhere, and it made it possible for people of all ages to feel. There was performance to it. There was drama to it that was that was liberating.
It was
and
a whole culture.
Yeah, it was, and you captured it in these clubs. So now we have just a couple minutes left, but Ian Schrager, he went to jail, got out, and has continued to do amazing things. Now I don't even know how many hotels he owns. You guys did not choose to continue down this path. Why did you separate and not continue in this way?
Well, we had two different factions in the Best of Friends. Our group was called the Best of Friends. We had five guys who really wanted to be in the nightclub business.
Mm-hmm.
I did not want to be in the nightclub business as a long-term proposition because it's right. not conducive to family life.
And sure.
I had a family I was raising, and I was doing pretty well in the corporate world. I was reluctant to give that up
sure.
because I saw that as a long-term opportunity and a good way to protect my family.
Mm-hmm.
Wayne Scarborough was made a judge. He had to leave the group because he can't hold a liquor license and be
no.
a judge. so he was the first to leave the group. So that left seven. I left next get away from that heavy nightlife environment because
sure.
at that point it was difficult for me with two little baby
sure.
girls. My wife was struggling to take care of them without any help and the emotional support because I wasn't there.
Yeah.
And then Andre Smith, who was also married and had two girls, he left right after I left. So that left five guys, and two of them wound up carving out their full career from nightclubs.
Oh, good.
So that was their trajectory. One of them who oversaw the construction of our clubs, he wound up going into working for as a consultant to the Board of Education to help assess their brick and mortar needs and supervise their construction projects.
Wow.
CP, who was the guy who hired all the acts, he wound up working at the Apollo Theater, running their liquor concession and still staying in touch with all the record company execs and the performers.
Right.
That's his bailiwick.
And you, I know you have retired, but you had an incredible career. Tell us very briefly, you have about a minute left. What did you do?
Well, I went back to work for advertising. I worked for Ogilvy & Mather, having started mm-hmm. at Young & Rubicam. And we put together a great campaign for Schaefer Beer. Miller Brewing heard about saw the campaign. They hired me. I went to Milwaukee and worked for Miller for 8 years. And then I wound up coming back to New York to work for a champagne and cognac company, Shefflin & Somerset, which was
yep.
renamed Moët Hennessy USA.
That's right.
And I worked for them for 12 years. 13 years as an employee, another seven as a consultant.
So, helping to create some of the
fantastic.
Most beautiful, fabulous events for our community
yes.
ever.
Yes.
And I appreciate all that you have done. So I want to let folks know, because we're out of time, we have been talking to Noel Henkin. He has written a book you need to read. It is called After Dark, Birth of the Disco Dance Party. Remember that if you offer a contribution of $20, we will send a book to you, an ebook to you right away. You can call us at 212-209-2950. And Noel, what's your website? How can people reach you?
They can reach me at discoafterdark.com, www.discoafterdark.com. There's a way to contact me through there.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much. It's been delightful to be with you. Can't
thank
wait
you.
To see you this summer.
Yes. We're going to dance.
We're going to dance. Thank
Keep
you,
dancing.
Noel.
Thank you so much.
Hey, guys, this has been a lot of fun. It's all about disco as we're celebrating Black Music Month. I hope you enjoyed this hour. Until next time, have a great day and make it count.
Kenny of Everything Old Is New Again, every Sunday night at 10. Please join me then, and please support WBAI at our brand new old number, which is 212-209-2950. Again, that's 212-209-2950. Hey, it's our old number, but it's new again, because everything old is new again. I like it.
Ladies and gentlemen, it's time for a celebration. The award-winning Midnight Ravers can now be heard every Friday from 12 midnight to 2 a.m. So wake the town and tell the people. We'll continue to present the best in music.